This is lecture 38. We are talking about non-perturbative ways of looking at our Euclidean space functional integral. And we have given some rigorous results and something on the basis of a normalization group. We want to turn finally to a few more comments about Monte Carlo. Our goal is to discuss possible ways to compute quantities which are averages in the distribution obtained by taking this distribution, normalizing it, so I will put a factor n in front this time. N stands for the real fact that the integral without anything else inside would simply be 1, and that we're interested then in calculating various moments or correlation functions here. 4 is enough to illustrate the point. This will be our average of our 4-point function in this distribution. Now, these are large dimensional integrals. There are many phi k's to deal with. There is one at every point of intersection of our lattice, although my illustration here is only 2 dimensions. If you take that up to 3, 4, 5, and possibly even higher dimensions, the number of lattice points, therefore the number of integration variables, becomes exceedingly large. It is a computational nightmare to try to just integrate those as you would normally, because in principle these integrations run from plus to minus infinity. They are many dimensional. That would be just too much to expect a computer to do. And moreover, there are vast regions of this space of where we're integrating where the distribution is relatively small, extremely small, and we're getting very small contributions of that. So I want to illustrate that with the aid of a very simple example and a one-dimensional example. So let's talk about e to the minus s of x. X is a function on the real line. I'll plot that as an illustration of an example we're talking about. So it could look like this. Could have a bump here, a second bump, and then tail off to infinity. Well, when we integrate that from plus to minus infinity to find a total area under that curve, we can do that according to the way Mr. Riemann would do. That is to say, we set up little rectangles here, count the area in the rectangles, and if we're content with an approximate answer, then we don't have to go to the limit. We can get our answer that way. I'm going to describe for you the so-called Monte Carlo method, which is a way not to evaluate this kind of integral, but a ratio of integrals. I want to calculate a moment of this quantity as a distribution. So I normalize it this way. So now it becomes a true probability distribution. And I put in some function. The simplest one I'm going to talk about is just the mean, and I'm going to do that integral there. So this will be then the average of x in that distribution. Let's see how Mr. Riemann would do that. And now I'm going to start out, first off, by making a very crude and simplified approximation to my function S, just to get the point across. So I'm going to give it three levels. So that is 2 units high. And in this interval, it's 1 unit high. And over in this interval, it is 3 units high. So this is, let's say that's 0, 1, 2, and 3 also on the horizontal axis. So this is my basic distribution. This is now my modified form for e to the minus s of x in this simplified example. All right. How do we calculate the denominator? Normally, we would put a point here and recognize that that is 2 units high. So that is, I'm doing the denominator here. So that is 2 times this width here. This is 1 times that width. And this is 3 times that height. Now, how do we calculate the numerator? We have weighting of 2 units for a distance over here. So, okay, we'll have to call that a half. So let's do that. We'll put a half out here. 1/2 times 1, that will be this unit. Then this point over here in the middle is 3/2 away, and that's times 1. And over here it's 2 1/2, that's 5/2, times 3 heights, times the height of 3. That's the Riemann sum way of calculating that integral. Question.
The first height is 2.
I beg your pardon, the first height indeed was 2. Thank you very much. Okay, now, let's do it another way. I have 2 units high, 1, same picture, and 3. I'm going to say that there are 2 points belonging to this place. 1 point belongs to this place, and 3 points belong to that place. And these points, there are a total of 6 of them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. These will be called XJs. They're along the x-axis. 2 of them live here, happily, at the point 1/2. 1 of them lives here at the point 3/2, and 1 lives, 3 more, sorry, live at the point 5/2. Somehow I've arranged them. Now, I will measure out from here. So there are 2 points at a distance 1/2. That's what that is. Then there is 1 point at a distance 3/2. And then there are 3 points at a distance of 5/2. And the total number of points is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So I'm simply averaging the distance of those several points. Now, the numbers are absolutely the same. The fact that there are 3 here is supposed to represent a factor proportional to the height. Now, I could have doubled this number. I could have put 4 here, 2 here, and 6 here. Let's pretend we do that this second time around. My friend Sam calculates it that way. So in the bottom, you will have 4 plus 2 plus 6. And then you will have 4 points, all at the distance 1/2, plus 2 points at the distance 3/2, and 6 points at the distance 5/2. And since I've doubled the numerator and doubled the denominator, the answer will be the same. I would like to find ways to distribute points in a relative weight proportional to the local height of the function. I may not be able to do it so precisely as my example has done, 4, 2, and 6. I may get 5 over here, 4 and 2 and 5 over here. So I'm calculating an approximation to the answer. I'm faced with living with approximations, and I'll take that. So what I'm going to try to do for you now is to show a way to distribute points which are relatively dense in the level representing the height of this function. And that will become our way to build the points. Once we've got the set of points present, then we can begin to take moments. I've showed you how to take the first moment here. But the same story would work for the second moment. I could do x squared here. All I would have to do is take the square of that distance, square of that distance, and the square of that distance. Okay, so here is the scheme. I'm going to erase my approximate story of the squares, and now we're going to take something a little bit more realistic that looks like that. So the first thing I do is I pick a point somewhere in a random place of the interval. And I evaluate my function. So that's my x0, that's my starting point. The second thing I do is I pick another point. So I'm going to go from x0, I'm going to add to that delta, that will give me x1. Unfortunately, I gave you very poor examples of those. So here's x0. I add to that delta to get x1. How did I choose delta? Delta is, again, a random choice. Perhaps I will say within a window of width b to minus b, I allow this to be a flat distribution of my next choice. So now I have two samples, x0 and x1. I take the quotient of those. This is my new one on top. This is my previous one on the bottom. I call this ratio capital R. In the example that I've illustrated to you, this point lies here, this point lies here. This number, then e to the minus s for this number, is larger than that. So this ratio R will be actually larger than unity. If R is greater than 1, choose x1 as the next point. I'm going to call it step, next step. If R, on the other hand, is less than 1, if I had actually moved in the opposite direction on this figure, for example, then I would have come down to this point over here, and my ratio here would have been wrong way.
Yeah. You've gone to a bigger S and it's e to the minus S.
I'm not talking about S being bigger, I'm talking about e to the minus S. Yeah.
The function is e to the S.
Oh, the function is e to the s.
The graph is e to the minus s.
Okay, sorry, I thought it was s. Forgive me.
No. If r is less than 1, I choose x1 as next step with a certain probability. How do I choose that probability? I will pick a random number r living between, let's say, less than or equal to 1, so it's a flat distribution. Flat distribution. And then I will take r and r together, and I choose the maximum of those. Well, no, I'll do it the other way around. If r is greater than little r, choose x1 is right. Okay. So I choose x1 as my next step if my ratio is bigger than this r I have chosen. On the other hand, if cap r is less than or equal to r, let's say, then I stay. I choose x0, my previous one, as my next step. In other words, I don't move at all. Now, then I repeat the process. I pick an x2 and compare that with x1 and a new r and go back through the cycle again. So let's see what's happening. In this particular example, x0 has indeed been replaced by x1 because that is better. On the other hand, over here, my next step might be a delta this direction, in which case I do not choose that one with certainty, but depending on the little random number I've chosen to pick out of my collection, the little r here, if that ratio which is here is smaller, so that ratio, let us call that, is about 0.85. If my ratio is bigger than the random number that I've chosen, then I will actually go to this next step. That will be my x2. Let me assume that's the case.
So is this like a weighted random walk?
A weighted random walk. If it's weighted, but it sometimes I don't make the move. So let's do that the next time. The next time I will choose my little delta this way, and I will be back around here. This would be my next possibility, my x3. But I find, no, that my random number r is that I picked out happens in that case to be larger, so I stay there. Okay. It takes a little exercise for yourself. But what will happen is this quantity will move toward regions of large values of e to the minus x. So starting with x0, I will end up, let's say, after 100 steps, step here, I find myself over here. That will be x100. And I declare that point is thermalized. I have step. That's called a walk. I have one walk. I have chosen a point which I consider to be well representative of where the function is large. Then I begin again. Then I choose another x0, completely starting again, and make another walk of 100 points, end up over here, and this will be my next point of my walks. And I collect these walks, the ends of these, after 100 steps of thermalization. And I only keep the end points, and they will end up being heavily distributed where this function is large and weakly present when it is not so large. And then I now have my collection of the x's, like I had approximately here on the board, my xj's, which were largely denser where the function was large, and I used those and took a few of my averages. And I do not spend much effort way out here where the function is small, because that will not make a major contribution to my averages. Question.
Do you need to worry about your starting point on this?
Sure. It's a black art, in my opinion, and a lot of trial and error, but some people are quite expert these days, and how wide should I choose my band in which to begin? Where do I start? How many steps do I make before I declare at the end of my walk to choose those? How many walks do I all need altogether to get reasonable statistics? This is, as I say, a black art, and trial and error is the best teacher for how to do these things. Okay. And I'm happy to share with you the fact that I am engaged with Larry Dumas in a major effort of this very kind to calculate some quantities by means of these Monte Carlo efforts.
It works only if you have very well-defined maximum.
So the question is, do you need well-defined maxima? I am also dealing with this kind of problem here, and sharp things involved. And this scale can be 1 over 100 on a scale where this thing is of order 1. And you might say to yourself, well, okay, mathematica could handle such an integral, but how about Monte Carlo? If I don't get any points in here, then it won't represent the fact that this is actually rather different. And I've run cases, I've had 5,000 walks on a single real line variables, and I've gone up to 50,000 walks. And these numbers were comparable with these numbers, and these numbers were within 1% of accuracy. She was finding that the fact that this thing was here and giving me the right answer. So I am very pleased by the fact that Monte Carlo could actually.
It's within the blackness of the art.
Yeah, sure. My intuition was this was going to be difficult, but it turned out to be much less difficult than I thought.
Okay, 5,000 walks is a lot. But, you know, give the thing a chance to find the small stuff.
Not compared to 10 to the 8th.
Not compared to 10 to the 8th.
One of the biggest risks is in the generating of the little r numerically, because you get so-called random number generators that have serial correlation in them that are badly hidden, and then you're really in trouble.
His point is well taken. It is absolutely critical to get as good a random number generator as you can lay your hands on. And
random number generators are done by multiplying large numbers together and taking out a little region in the middle sometimes, but this can have some hidden periodicities that are not so clear, and they have led to problems before, and they must be carefully sought out for. Okay, I want to summarize the section 7.4 here, where we've looked at different methods, and just to tell you, emphasize, if you haven't got the message yet, that expressions of the following kind, e to the j phi dnx minus one half gradient phi squared plus m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth dnx d phi. Expressions of this type, even though I know what I want that this to be normalized, so when j equals 0, I get unity, even if I know that much about it, and it looks like this. This is a very ill-defined concept. Nevertheless, that I have gone to Euclidean space to make everything positive here. This looks like the Fourier transform of a positive distribution. This looks like a characteristic functional, and in many ways we hope it will be. But what do these quantities really mean? What does the fourth power of a random field, which is a distribution value quantity? What about the h-bar correction terms that are needed but not written down? Remember, there's an h-bar dividing all these expressions here. There are h-bar corrections here when you go from the classical motivation to the quantum theory. What are they? How do they come in? They are simply not there. This is almost a classical expression, and there is much work to be done in going further. Okay, I just wanted to make that point. And I'm sure you have seen me emphasize things of that kind before. Okay, we have one more section in.
John, are you going to give us Monte Carlo results for this expression? Or has there been anything been learned of that particular way of approaching it, or is that still open?
You were not here the last time we were together? That's correct?
Yeah,
I'm sure. We're here. So the question is, am I going to give you Monte Carlo results? And I drew these pictures on the board last time. Unfortunately, I didn't have the book, the paper with me. This is coupling constant, so our lambda, if you will. I call this something. Not a very illuminating statement. But that something is rather like a phi to the 4 minus a 3 phi to the squared squared. So if the distribution of the field was Gaussian, this would be 0. So when the coupling constant is 0, it is 0. So these curves started out looking like that. And like this, and then like this for n equals 3. This was for, let us say, a is point 8, I don't know what I used last time, A equals...
9.6 and 0.1.
Yeah, I've got that in my notes, and I think everybody else does. My question was, are there other more detailed results, or is this in essence it?
I'm sure there are reams of detailed results, but this was the summary I wanted to give you of the implication that in three dimensions, as A got smaller, it converged to something which was not zero, therefore the quartic term meant something, whereas in four dimensions, it looked like it was still going down, so all of this disappeared. That's the evidence we have that says that phi to the fourth theory is trivial. Besides the renormalization group analysis, this is the evidence from Monte Carlo. Further question before we move on to the last section of chapter 7. Okay. This is 7.5. Non-renormalizability. And the hardcore interactions. Non-renormalizable theories, which for us was our quartic theory in five and higher dimensions, are an ill-understood branch of quantum field theory. You may question why we need to care about those, but one of the motivating forces is quantum gravity, which, from a perturbative point of view, is well known to be non-renormalizable. Can we understand what non-renormalizability is? On the one hand, perturbation theory tells us we need an endless series of new types of counterterms. On the other hand, from the point of view of the lattice calculation and the rigorous results, I told you that if you take the quartic coupling, let that coefficient be arbitrary, let the coefficient of the mass term be arbitrary, and then take the continuum limit, you got a Gaussian answer, you got a trivial answer. Those things seem completely different from me, that I need a whole family of counterterms, and according to the rigorous analysis, which agrees with the Monte Carlo for phi to the fourth in four dimensions, by the way, that I go to a free theory, completely different, and I consider both of them unacceptable. How can I have a non-trivial classical theory, which such theories are? You quantize it, you get something which is trivial quantum mechanically, then you take the classical limit again. A classical limit of a trivial quantum theory has got to be a Gaussian or free classical theory. It's not the same classical theory you started with. So something's been going wrong. And I'm going to present what I consider to be a promising approach to that. First, we're going to give you the overview, qualitative picture. Then I'm going to give you a quantum mechanical example, and then at the end of this section, we're going to talk about its application to quantum field theory. So let's talk about an integral. I'll use round brackets just to save my wiggles, hands and wiggles. For a while, we have, I'm switching to H just for no reason at all. I won't put in any details because this will not mean too much. I mean, I'm not being very specific here. I have an integral of this type I'd like to talk about. W0 is a bounded below so-called free term, if you like. V is a bounded below potential term. Lambda is a non-negative coupling term. So the integral exists, makes sense. I'm going to describe this by having a subscript lambda. There is the free case, which has its own coupling constant. I won't ever detail the A part, which is W0 of phi, and is nothing more than the evaluation of the previous one at lambda equal to 0.
Or just put it another way, you've never put in the iteration.
I tell you that there are two ways to look at this expression. First way, let's use the blackboard and talk about points on the blackboard as fields. And inside a field, inside this region rather, is a region where W0 is finite. So these are field values here for which this term is finite. I'm going to put down a curve, similar curve for V, and I'm going to put it down two different ways. The first way I'm going to do it is to have V surrounding W0. So this means that if you are inside of W, W0 is finite, so your point in here, then you're also in the middle of V. So that implies that V is finite. Let's quickly go to the other one to make the distinction. Here is W0, and here is V. And this is a situation in which W0 being finite does not imply that V is finite. Here is a region where W0 is finite and V is finite, but here's a region W0 finite and V is not finite. What does this mean? If W0 is finite, W0 is controlling the support of this measure. If V is finite at the same time, V is not interfering with that support. So in this case, if I take the acting theory and take its limit as the coupling constant goes to zero from the positive side, I will come back to the free theory. I argue that if you make the same question over here, once you have introduced this extra potential to go from here to here, you have said to some of the fields which were allowed by the W0, I'm sorry, you can no longer be there because Mr. V forbids you. So those fields that were part of that original support are absent. And this thing does not limit to our original free action, free functional, but there's something else I'll call a pseudo-free. What is this? Let's describe this guy a little bit more clearly. We'll introduce a function chi, which is either 1 or 0. And this is 1 in the regions where W0 is finite and V0 is finite. It is 0 in the regions where W0 is finite and V0 is infinite. So this S0 prime H, normalization e to the I H phi, has a projection term here, which says certain of the original fields are allowed and certain of the other fields are not allowed. And those that are not allowed have been projected out by the presence of the field. This is a hardcore. That's what a hardcore does. A hardcore comes along and projects out certain quantities. You perhaps remember this from nuclear physics. I have two configuration coordinates, x1 and x2. x1 describes the motion of one particle. x2 describes the motion of another particle. These two particles have a certain size, and they simply cannot get any closer than a certain distance. So to say that the two particles have equal distance, x1 equals x2, is forbidden. Therefore, there's a little band on the side of those, which is forbidden. These particles cannot enter that. So this part of the configuration space is then simply erased from the story. That's what the hardcore in nuclear physics tends to do. This is a very analogous situation. Now, I want to give you an example of that. I'd like to give you two examples, and I will. First example is from quantum mechanics.
e to the minus 1 half x dot squared dt. So that is our regular Wiener process to deal with. We know what that is. I'm going to integrate from x prime to x double prime. Let me just schematically illustrate it. Here is t equals 0. T equals capital T. Here is x prime. Here is x double prime. So I'm going integrating over paths that look like this. And we know what that looks like. It's 1 over square root 2 pi cap t e to the minus x double prime minus x prime squared over 2t. I'm not going to put in a perturbation. Minus lambda v of x dt. And then I'm going to take the limit as lambda goes to 0. I'm going to remove the perturbation. And I would like to do it in such a way that it leaves no residue behind, and so that this answer will be the same. And the choice of my potential will be 1 over x to a power alpha. Alpha is going to be greater than 0. So this has a singularity when x equals 0. It means the paths that reach 0 or try to cross 0 have got to cope with this singularity. And I tell you that for, here's the scorecard, alpha less than 1, but of course still positive, it works. Okay, I can use this particular v of x will work. V of x equal 1 over x to the alpha is such that even though I put it in there, even though it is looking singular for the paths that reach there, as I turn lambda to 0, those paths are restored. They haven't been eliminated. In fact, there's tunneling with those paths, and the tunneling survives. When alpha is bigger than 2, that situation, so this is what I will call a continuous perturbation. Continuous in the sense I put it in, and as lambda goes to 0, I go continuously back to where I started from. Over here, on the other hand, this is a discontinuous perturbation. If I try to put in v of x where an alpha is bigger than 2, and then turn it off, all those paths that have reached the origin are excluded. The answer is not that. The answer is this. Like an image situation. And it insists that you only go from positive to positive, negative to negative. You could never go from a negative, from a positive to a negative sign. Those parts are wiped out altogether. What happens in the interval between? Fascinating story. And in a few minutes, I want to summarize that for you. If, yes, question.
No question.
How did the two just, I mean, you just consider 2 greater than alpha. Why not? So, you're partitioning the alphas into 3 different, and it just happens that it's 2. Right. Okay.
Okay. If I blindly take this as my choice for alpha bigger than 1, I will automatically be discontinuous. So I will try to resist it. I will say, oh, no. I'm going to regularize my term. And then look at the limit of the regularization. First, to define my expression, and then see what happens. If this is my only regularization, I'm stuck at one. I want to go beyond one. Okay. I will allow myself a modification to the regularization, which says that the V of epsilon of X choice, limit epsilon to zero, must equal the original V everywhere except possibly at the point X equals zero. At X equals zero, it's singular. But I want this regularization. This is obviously a regularization which goes to that, but there are other regularizations which do that too. And my regularization will look like this. It will be a function k, leave a little space, times delta of x, a Dirac delta function. So I'm saying that clearly, as epsilon goes to zero, this will go to that. This never sees anything beyond x equals zero, so I've satisfied this condition. And my goal is to find a suitable k function to do that. That k will depend on epsilon, and it will depend on alpha, and will depend, surprisingly, on the coupling constant lambda. Now I'm going to give you the answer. I'm going to give you the k's. The form of the k, which in the interval one to two will be continuously connected to the free theory. Here's the form of the k. Okay, it's hard to appreciate the beauty of this when I give it to you all at once, but that's okay. There's a sum. There are coefficients depending on lambda and epsilon. The epsilon is our regularization parameter. And they come in the form J, 2 minus alpha minus 1. This is a power series in J, a power series in lambda. J equals 1 up to capital J. And there are numerical coefficients, case of J, which I will tell you about. Let's make sure we understand this. Lambda is a power series. For J equals 1, lambda doesn't appear at all. So the first term in this series is lambda independent. The next term is has lambda the first part, then lambda the second part, etc. Epsilon is the strength of the divergence, because alpha is less than 2. These numbers are all less than 1. So alpha, this is inverse power, and therefore there is a divergence term here. An infinite coefficient of this is needed, and this is the right form of it. What is the kj? The kj's satisfy a recursion relation. Minus 1 over 1 minus j, 2 minus alpha, summation, q equals 1, j minus 1, kj minus q, kq. So if I give you k1, you can find all the other k's, and k1 is 2 over alpha minus 1. That's k1. And with K1, you can build up to K2, then you can build up to K3, and so on. This sum goes up to, what did I say? J minus 1, that's not right. It's up to capital J. And what is capital J? It tells you how many terms you need. You take 2 minus alpha, you invert it, take the integer part of that number, and that is J. For example, if alpha equals 1.89 and 1 over 2 minus alpha equals 9.09, so J is equal to 9. Alpha equals 1.91, 1 over 2 minus alpha equals 11.1111, so J equals 11. So as you get closer and closer to 2, you need more and more terms. At alpha equals 2, this number is infinity. When alpha equals 2, this dependence is gone. Every term has the same divergence, epsilon to the minus 1. Therefore, I can sum that series. And indeed, for alpha equals 2, the V epsilon of x is equal to 1 over x plus epsilon squared minus 4 epsilon to the minus 1, 1 plus 8 lambda squared root the bottom delta of x. And the series that you would generate this way for alpha equals 2 converges to that in its radius of convergence. Now, I want to draw a parallel between what I've just illustrated for you from quantum mechanics and problems in quantum field theory. Problems in quantum field theory had divergences. Those divergences, like the mass divergence or the coupling constant divergence, needed counterterms. Those counterterms eventually would involve polynomials in the coupling constant. Remember the lambda squared terms we talked about? We talked about lambda squared as a coefficient there. Lambda squared are coefficients that appear here as well. We have a counterterm needed, and we have polynomial in the coupling constant needed. You cannot ignore the lambda dependence, which you would normally have thought was outside in one parameter here. You cannot do that. You've got to go in such a way with the lambda. Okay. Polynomial dependence in lambda, I argue, polynomial in lambda is to be like our what we call the super renormalizable theory. That was our 5-4 in two dimensions and three dimensions. A infinite series in lambda, infinite order polynomial, as the physicists like to call it, that was our strictly renormalizable situation. And that is exactly analogous to the 5-4-4 theory. Yes, question?
Well, how did you get that?
Let me beg off on that question at the moment. Should there be time sometime, I'll be happy to tell you or more people at once. But
And isn't that the same thing if you have an infinite number of counterterms?
Where?
So normalizable if J is infinity.
But J is infinity, no. I have one particular operator that I have. I just have an infinite series coefficient that defines the coefficient. Now, when I deal with 5-4-5, that's my non-renormalizable situation over here. This was alphas between 1 and 2. This was alpha equals 2. If I raise alpha beyond 2 here, no power series represents what's happening, because what is happening is that these paths that would otherwise be there and are there, you have made them stay there for every alpha between 1 and 2 by putting in this counterterm. These paths contribute. And as lambda goes to 0, those paths will survive, giving you the full answer. But once you've exceeded alpha greater than 2, like here, there is nothing you can put on this V of epsilon, no regularization which will resist the fact that you have canceled these paths, and therefore you have a different qualitative expression. This is the analog of what I meant by the pseudo-free theory in the general discussion we had previously. So I claim that this is the analog over here, what we do know and understand for the quantum mechanics problems, what has happened, alpha greater than 2. We have a real answer here. This is our calculation for the alpha greater than 2. We can actually calculate things when alpha is a strong singularity. And I say, by analogy, this story should tell us, in principle, the kind of things that is happening for the non-renormalizable quantum field theory. And that, what is telling us, is that these guys act like hard cores in the field space. Unfortunately, the next time, because I wish I had finished it today, but the next time we get together, we only have two more lectures next week, I'm going to start by giving you a inequality in functions space that points very strongly to the fact that exactly this phenomena happens in quantum field theory. And then for the remainder of the last two lectures, I'm going to actually solve an insoluble problem and show you, as a quantum field theory, that that thing literally does happen in a certain particular model. Okay, have a good weekend. Thank you.